This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by MintSim, the best way to get cheap 4G LTE data in the U.S. Use offer code ACFREESHIP for free first-class shipping on any MintSim purchase. Hey, everybody. My name is Daniel Bader, and you are listening to the Android Central podcast for Thursday, September 14th, 2017. I'm joined today by two lovely gentlemen, all the way from Manchester, England, Alex Dobie. Welcome back.
Good to be back. 2 weeks in a row. We'll see how long this lasts.
Yes, this is a Jerry Seinfeld streak going on three now. Two, hopefully three.
We'll see. Probably not four, but we'll see.
All right, and back for yet another video. Sup, Unbox Therapy. I don't know why that just like popped into my head. Jerry Hildenbrand, how are you, man?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. It's been a busy week, not a lot of sleep, but got a lot of stuff to dive into. So let's get started. We'll start with you, Alex, because you published a pretty sizable review for something.
Initial review.
Well, I was going to get to that. I was going to say it's a pretty sizable review for a first impressions review, but your V30 thoughts, we may claim they're initial, but I feel they're pretty comprehensive. So let's dive right in. We talked a lot about the phone last week, and you've had some time since to make them a bit more concrete. How are you feeling about it now that the Note 8 is coming out tomorrow? You think this is the phone to compete with the Note 8 this year?
In terms of sales, no. I mean, nothing's going to come close, with the exception, obviously, of the iPhone. But I think the way I called it in my video review, or video initial review, whatever, is that this is probably going to be quite a solid sleeper hit for LG this year. It's not going to be... I mean, the V10 and the V20 were just weird in a lot of ways. In the sense that the G5 was weird, in the sense that the other LG phones with gimmicks have been... just not great at the core experience. The difference with the V30 is it's like the G6, it's just first and foremost a good phone, and then there's all this other stuff. There's the dual camera, the quad DAC. Every V30 has wireless charging now, which is great. So it benefits from that, and of course the fact that thanks to Snapdragon 835 and the fact that we have big batteries and small phones now. Just the fundamentals of using it are really, really good. Battery life is great. The screen, despite that there's some weird issues in low light with lower brightness levels, with it crushing shadow details, for the most part, I'm really happy with. Some people have been seeing like blotches in some areas. I'm not seeing that on mine. But again, bear in mind, everyone who has a V30 has a pre-production unit. So bottom line for me is this is just a really good overall phone, and it sounds kind of like a cop-out saying that, because generally every phone is at least good these days, especially at the high end. But that's not necessarily been a given, and a lot of phones are good and just boring. LG actually manages to be good and interesting with all these other features, like the Cinelog shooting mode, like the wide-angle camera, the quad DAC. These are real differentiating features, and a lot of manufacturers struggle to first be good and second to differentiate, and LG is doing both with this phone.
Right. So you mentioned in the review that video really takes a center stage here, and the presentation in the US spent a lot of time on those features. But I'm just wondering, what's your impression on how much people actually use the video capture features of their smartphone, other than just to occasionally press the record button and then never really do anything with them?
Well, that's the big question. It's something I touched on the video review as well. You're obviously, most of the time, you're just going to use auto mode. There's a big record button whenever you start the camera up. Chances are the vast majority of people who will buy a V30 will just hit that button, and then probably they'll never be aware of the LG Cinelog mode or any of the special color modes that exist in there, which is kind of a shame. But then again, it's an LG V-series phone. They've always targeted, as well as the mainstream, because obviously you're selling it in a carrier store, they've always targeted sort of content creators, people who want to do something a little bit special in terms of video on their phones. And if that's you, then, you know, maybe you want to get footage off your phone at 4K or whatever, put it into a YouTube video or something. You want the extra dynamic range that the Cinelog mode gives you because you're going to be crunching it later in Final Cut or Premiere or whatever. So that's a minority of users, and it seems weird that that's, you know, a central pillar of the phone. But, you know, it's very important at the same time. So it's a niche feature. It still works really well. Is it a reason to buy the phone? Probably not, but it's a nice thing to have.
Yeah, I mean, we heard a lot about video on the during the presentation of the new iPhones, the iPhone 8, iPhone X, and we'll touch on those a bit later. But
the iPhone what?
Sorry. No, I'm just going to call it X because, you know, you can't come at me, bros.
Next year's what, iPhone Y? iPhone
XY, I think.
X2.
But, you know, a lot of it comes down to frames per second. That, you know, there's 4K 60 frames. There's 1080p at 240, things like that. The video capabilities of the V30 are a lot less marketable. They're aimed at a much smaller swath of the population. But it seems ironic that as the V series gets more capable on the video side of things and audio, it's also trying to go more mainstream as a brand.
Yeah, I think LG's kind of stuck between these two different things here. On the one hand, they have the G6, which never really stood much chance of directly competing with the GS8. So they also need to make their other flagship as mainstream as possible and to have as much mass appeal as possible. But they also need that differentiating feature, not only against the V30's immediate competitors, but also their own phone, which they also sell. And, you know, video is the obvious place to do that. It's always been a differentiator for the V series. It is maybe an awkward sell in some way, but, you know, this is, LG has a history of doing this. The V series has always been about content creation, and I think it works pretty well. We'll have to see how it progresses with software updates and stuff. Of course, we're still dealing with a pre-production device here, but yeah, it's in terms of what the color settings actually do to the overall image, it can be quite striking, and it's probably that there's more of a visual aspect to it than just, oh, it records more frames per second. It's hard to see, you know, you talk about the regular consumer wanting a 60 FPS phone. I would say actually it's easier to sell them on something that gives you these really, really unique color settings.
Right. I mean, especially since they're not difficult to use. They're just a single tap.
Sure. I mean, it's literally, yeah, it's a single tap. There's something similar. This kind of got lost a little bit in the presentation of the phone. But there is a similar feature in the manual shooting mode. So you can go in, you can tap on an icon. There's actually a separate app that you could download. You can look at additional presets. So you have this graphy feature where it isn't just color settings, it's also white balance. There are specific ISO and shutter speed settings that you can use for very, very specific situations. So, for example, a lot of phones have a fireworks mode. LG has specific ISO shutter speed and white balance settings for recording fireworks over a cityscape, and that might seem like a very specific thing, but if you know that's something that you're doing and it's, you know, something that's just there for you to use, it seems like something that could quite easily be built out over time. Maybe the same applies to the video side of things. So what we're seeing now is just the initial loadout of these video modes, and there's more potential there for creativity with more features being added over time than just, okay, you know, the new iPhone shoots at 60 FPS or whatever.
Right. So I also want to touch a little bit on audio. So in your review, you say, as other manufacturers are finding ever more dubious reasons to kill the headphone jack, LG embraces wired audio. You know, they come with a B&O headphone or earbuds in the box, and they're good. I mean, braided cable, nice build quality, very recognizable brand. Is audio something that, as you know, this is literally the antithesis of everything Apple is doing, especially, but many others as well, Essential, Motorola. Is this a selling point? You know, is this going to be something that LG can utilize in its marketing and say, not only are we leaning into a wired audio, but we're doing it better than ever before?
So a couple of years ago, when the B-Series first launched, you would probably say no. So we first had the quad DAC way back in the V10. Back then, everything had a headphone jack. But now it's almost like, you know, whether by design or by accident, LG suddenly has a really compelling differentiator for themselves. Obviously, so many, like I said, so many manufacturers are coming up with these, you know, bizarre reasons to come to just ditch the headphone jack. The more dubious reasons, you know, you look at HTC and Motorola, there's really no reason why they couldn't put a headphone jack in there if they really wanted to. I would even include, you know, prejudging maybe the next Pixels in that as well.
All right.
So, yeah, I think obviously there are a lot of people who will look at an iPhone and the lack of a headphone jack would be a serious mark against it. LG isn't just including that. They're including that and they're making it way better than anything else with a headphone jack. And that again, plays into the idea of this, of even though the V series is more mainstream now, that it still is, to a certain extent, this power user phone. And you know, funny to think of a headphone jack as being a power user feature, but this is where we are. So I think, yeah, it is a differentiator for them. But it's, you know, whether it's by design is debatable, it could well just be by accident. This is the environment we find ourselves in late 2017.
Okay, so Jerry, most people don't have expensive high impedance headphones to plug into a V30 and really get that extra the power from the extra from the amplifier, and they may not be able to tease out all of those details from the DAC, the quad DAC that's inside. Will the average person, I know you haven't used the phone, but will the average person be able to tell the difference?
Probably not. And that's with a lot of variables here. Most people aren't going to have source material that has enough different in it. And then, I mean, you know yourself, it's, you have to really listen to pick out the differences, a high-end audio transmission can make. But mostly it's because of the source material. People have MP3s they downloaded off some skanky site on the internet, and they're not good quality.
Right. And Alex, you were going to mention something, but I just want to bring up one other thing. There is a move to stream higher quality files. MQA is a new lossy audio codec, but it's much higher quality than MP3. And it's not nearly as bandwidth intensive as FLAC. Is this just, you know, you're basically with LG, you're laying the groundwork, if you will, for better source material over the next couple of years?
If you're asking me, yes. You know, that's, I was going to qualify that one day it will make a difference, but will you have your V30 by then?
Right.
Or will you have, you know, two phones away?
Possibly. I mean, if you look at, I can't speak for the streaming providers, but if you look at what Google's been doing on the web with move towards WebP and WebM in different places, the whole point there is moving more quickly to these next generation encoding formats that let you push out higher quality, whether it's video or pictures. And there's no reason why they couldn't also do, I mean, obviously there's the kind of record label angle that they like to get in the way sometimes. But you could very well see a situation where even, you know, they may even charge more for it, but you could, you know, potentially it would just be something you get as standard as in your YouTube Red or Google Play Music subscription further down the line. Google has an interest in doing that. They've already done it in Chrome and in YouTube and in other areas. It would be a very Google thing to do. Other thing I was going to mention has to do with...
Oh, we lost him.
I think we lost Alex.
Oh, that's like leaving us on such a tease. I was like, oh no, yep. What does he think? But while we get him back, because, you know, he's all the way on the other side of the Atlantic. So, you know, the rotary phones have to, you know, make their way through the entire, you know, the 10-digit phone number again. I do want to touch on this emphasis on higher quality source material, because it's so interesting, Jerry. Over the last few years, we've seen video be supported by all of these new standards. And we've talked about this in a previous podcast, but even a phone like the new iPhone, for example, is bringing it back to the 4, but we've talked about it with the Galaxy S8, the Note 8, the G6, the V30. probably the upcoming Pixels HDR. It's something that you can sell, you know, better,
yeah,
more vivid colors.
It's right. It's easy to see.
Yeah.
Even if you're not a videophile, you can see the difference when they're side by side.
But you and I have had so many conversations about how difficult it is to sell people on higher quality audio. And Tidal had that problem,
yeah,
right from the beginning. I mean,
exactly.
This is something that has been tried. And we've gone through this cycle almost where we started out in, you know, way back in the day, you know, people really emphasized VBR, like really good quality, nicely encoded VBR MP3s. But that was because we had space on our local devices to store them. And then, yeah, as streaming took off, we necessarily had to lower the average bit rate of these streams because LTE wasn't fast enough, or people just didn't have the bandwidth every month. We didn't have unlimited plans. We didn't have zero rating. That came around 2014 or so, 2015. But in the intervening years between like the first couple of years of Spotify and RDO and Pandora and that, you know, we were listening to 56 or 96 KB, you know, kilobytes per second audio, and people didn't really complain, even though it's very obvious that we were experiencing a dip in quality.
That's just, most people have never been demoed. You know, okay, here is a studio master that's been cleaned. It has almost zero noise. Here's something that with a really good, you know, audio processing gear inside it and a nice pair of headphones. Listen to your favorite song and then listen to it on, you know, normal from whatever streaming service you use. You would instantly see the difference. But most people haven't done that. And they just want to hear some music, and what's easy and convenient is fine.
But here's the other part of it. I wouldn't even know where to go to get these high quality streams. Like I know intellectually that I could, like, I don't know, go to iTunes or go to 7 Digital and pay for an album or a single that's in really high quality FLAC,
mm-hmm,
and listen to it. But these are not things that most people in 2017,
right,
really care about. They just want the convenience. And, you know, my favorite day of the week is Friday when I get to open Spotify and go to the new releases. And there are dozens and dozens of new releases every week. And I think that is that is more important to most people than hearing,
sure,
your favorite album on, you know, much higher quality than you know, the average Spotify stream.
I agree completely.
Hello, you're back.
Hey. I'm back, by the way, yeah. I mean, in any kind of streaming service, convenience is always going to trump quality. We saw this with YouTube. We've seen this with just about every service that's done it. YouTube back in the day was, you know, crappy 360p or whatever in a 4x3 window. Now YouTube is 4K up to 60fps, or perhaps even beyond that now. I think certainly the demand is there. In terms of wanting, you know, people wanting audio at higher quality, and the technology is slowly starting to catch up with it, especially as LTE becomes faster. That's one of the main use cases, especially since, you know, regular LTE is more than fast enough now to stream, you know, your standard 28 kilobits per second MP3. Yeah, I think as more phone makers and also streaming service providers, there's a lot of competition there still, as people want to differentiate themselves a little bit more there. It's going to be one of those things that just emerges as kind of an obvious thing to push, in the same way that video streaming services have been pushing that in the past couple of years.
I think to see a streaming service move to serving files any better than 320 kbps MP3s is going to take Apple or Google, somebody that can eat the cost,
mm-hmm,
to let people know how good it sounds, because that's not cheap. It's probably four times as expensive.
You're right saying Apple or Google, because it's also going to take someone with someone that has hardware that they want to sell you as well to be able,
right,
to push it.
Oh, so Neil Young.
Yeah. Hey, you know, don't
well,
the Pono player sounded great. Don't diss
I'm
that
not,
thing.
But
diss,
I also,
diss the idiot that tried to sell
I'm making fun of it because it's I mean, it's maybe Sony is a better example of this because Sony touts its, you know, best-selling digital music players mm-hmm. that are made of pure gold and cost $1,400. Mm-hmm. And these
people
are,
actually buy them.
But absolutely. I mean, people buy them. And I used to live on HeadFi.org, so I know all about the audiophile community. Jerry, you are an asshole and introduced me to MassDrop, which is one of the most addictive communities on the internet.
I hear you. So, it's insane.
And if you haven't checked out MassDrop, if you like audio, headphones, amps, DACs, anything, if you're enthusiastic about the Quad DAC and the V30, check out MassDrop because it's basically a place where you buy discounted audio equipment, audiophile equipment, and it's amazing. And there's so many very, very intelligent people mm-hmm. helping you out, and it's a very welcoming community. So if you're a noob to audiophile stuff, and I'm, you know, this is a free plug, like I'm not getting anything from this. So there's a couple I like while we're talking about this, there's a couple of sides that I really want to touch on, but I also am cognizant of the fact that last week we had a 2-hour podcast because there were so many of them. So let's talk a little bit about the fact that tomorrow the Galaxy Note 8 is going to be available. Is it available in the UK as well, Alex, or just in North America tomorrow?
It is. It's available in at the very least Europe and North America. I think some other countries have different launch dates. So it's a large chunk of the world that gets the Note 8 tomorrow.
Excellent. Okay, so Andrew is not here, but he reviewed the phone and we talked about it at length. I've been using it. I've been using it as my daily driver for the past few days, except for today, which when I put my SIM card in the Essential phone, and we can talk about that a bit later. But I love the Note 8 more than I thought I would. I thought I would be ambivalent about it, and I'm not. And it just goes to show how much work the company did to make it just about as mature and experienced as you can get in a smartphone today. And it's just so funny. Like, there are so many instances where after the iPhone X announcement, people are now looking at Samsung's high-end phones and going, oh, okay, well, I understand all of these decisions in retrospect. You know, like the removal of the home button, it makes sense because you want as big a screen on the front as possible, things like that. And this just feels like Samsung made a lot of the correct decisions, even though, Alex, I'm sure when you get the phone tomorrow, you'll agree the phone is a little bit too tall.
Yeah, that's what I was just sort of chomping in the bit to ask you about, because when I don't have one here yet, obviously, I was using the one that Andrew has a little bit when I was in Berlin. And I mean, even having used a Galaxy S8 Plus a lot this year, I mean, the Note 8 is tall, like noticeably taller than the S8 Plus. And that it's to do with the shape as well as just the sheer size, and that you have the chin, the forehead that are just a little bit bigger, and the phone itself is a little bit boxier. And I'm not sure. Were you using a regular S8 or a Plus before?
I went straight from the S8 Plus to the Note 8, and it has been a significant
transition.
It's a significant jump in size, if only because the Note 8 doesn't fit in any of my pockets. It protrudes by a centimeter. on every, I mean, I wear Uniqlo jeans. Like, I don't own any other jeans. So if you wear Uniqlo jeans, the Note 8 will not fit in them. Just FYI. But I think it's worth the trade off. Maybe because I'm enamored with the sheer space that you have on screen. I've been reading a book on the Note 8 that I was reading on an iPad before. And I really do not notice a difference in the experience, except for the fact that I don't need to carry around an iPad. So, you know, that's nice. I mean, obviously the S8 Plus is not significantly smaller, but this does feel like a tablet.
Can you sit down with a Note 8 in your pocket?
Yeah, it's a little awkward, but
I mean, like, having used the V30 for the past couple of weeks, these are the kind of things that I'm wondering about going probably to a Note 8 from tomorrow. The one thing I've really enjoyed about the V30 is the fact that it's almost, you know, it gets back to the initial promise of this taller form factor where you can actually have the extra screen real estate, but in something that is easy to hold. And it seems like Samsung has almost traded back on that in a little bit in some way with making the Note as big and as boxy as it is, even at that super tall aspect ratio.
I know this is kind of in the weeds, but when you compare the aspect ratio of the GS8 Note 8 series, which is slightly taller compared to the width than the G and the V series by LG, I think LG made the right decision. I think the 2:1 aspect ratio or 18:9 is the correct one. You get slightly more horizontal real estate at the expense of vertical, but at the same time, you also get phones that don't feel abnormally tall. Because even if LG were to make the V40 6.3 inches, it's not going to feel quite as cumbersome. It may be Nexus 6 levels wide. I don't think it'll be that wide. I don't have the math right in front of me. But in terms of the vertical dimensions, I don't think it would be that awkward. And Samsung's running into basically a hard wall here because it cannot make the subsequent S8 Note or S and Note series any taller than this. I just don't think they can.
The engineering challenge that they're going to have to solve to do that is basically freeing up space in terms of stuff they store either inside the chassis or around the back of the phone. The obvious thing they could do next year and are rumored to do is get the fingerprint sensor under the display. If they can do that, great. That's going to ease up some of the usability concerns. But Samsung almost now, I mean, it's funny. Back in the day, Samsung with a Note used to have the biggest phone with the biggest battery, and that was one of the reasons to get a Note. And now, compared to other phones with this form factor, they almost have an inbuilt advantage because when you're dealing with a current flagship phone, space inside is at such a premium. If you had to fit an S Pen in there, that's actually, you know, the equivalent to a decent amount of battery that you can no longer fit in the phone. And it's, you know, it's impressive that they've got as much capacity in there as they have, but it's still something that isn't going to go away for them. I don't know. Let's bring it back to, obviously, you've been using the Note. How have you found battery life compared to the V30? Because a lot of people have been looking at the capacity side by side and saying maybe the V30 should be getting more.
I think Andrew had it right. It's a consistent morning to night phone. The V30, I'm running pre-production software that's earlier than yours, so I really don't want to say with any certainty that I have good battery life. I had a few days with the V30 where it basically just died in the afternoon, and there was no rhyme or reason. But I'm running a European Note with, I believe, production software now. I got an OTA update the other day about a gigabyte, so it was a sizable update, and it improved a lot about the performance of the Note. So my guess is that I'm running shipping software now, and it's been very consistent, even though it's not optimized for North American networks. So again, I don't think I'm the right judge here, just because I'm not running phones that are meant to be run in Canada. But I don't think, you know, the difference is that, are you looking for a phone that is going to be alive the following morning? And if so, why? Like, what is the reason that you want to eke out those extra 5 or 6 hours?
People don't like to charge their phone when they sleep. There are a lot of people that just feel that way.
They don't want to charge their phone?
Right. Head into our forums, and I was surprised. I thought that was something that everybody did. While you're asleep, you charge your phone, but a lot of people don't.
And it's funny, we're talking about two phones here which don't have that class of super fast charging the way that OnePlus and Huawei do. That's really the antidote to not charging your phone overnight, that you have maybe 30 minutes in the morning, and however low the battery is, you're always going to be able to get, if not to full, then almost to full in that time. I kind of agree. I mean, it's always going to be an awkward balance for manufacturers trying to come up with a device that's as attractive and thin and whatever as you know, V30, while also including a big enough battery. But I don't know. I think I'm kind of past the point that I expect 2-day battery life out of phones. You know, the biggest thing for me this generation is we've actually had CPUs, which even with intensive use, won't absolutely destroy a battery over the course of a day. That's probably been a bigger revelation for me this year than, you know, having phones with gigantic battery capacities.
Okay, so I want to use this to launch into an aside that I planned for about wireless charging, because I actually think that it's worth talking about. You know, the iPhone X brings wireless charging back into the fore of mainstream conversation. It was there for a while when the Galaxy S, I believe it's the 6 that introduced wireless charging, or is it the 7? No, it was the 6. The 5 had it as an optional backplate. That made
a bunch of them had these horrible backplates that would make the phone like an inch thick.
Yeah.
But yeah, the 6 was the one that had the first one that had it built in.
Right. And then but that was just Qi, I believe. And then, regardless, the S7 made it PMA and Qi together. And, you know, this is the other thing. When you talk about phones that may not have all day battery life or may, if you leave them alone, die before the end of the day, you can have these charging pads all over your house and top it up every couple of hours. If you're working, you just put it on the pad. You don't even have to worry about it. Jerry, this is going to be a feature that I think people want. I know I like it. I have one of those new Samsung convertible chargers right next to my workstation. And I now have a bunch of phones, the Galaxy S8, the S8 Plus, the Note 8, the V30, with the Moto Z2 Force with optional, you know, Moto Mod backing. Mm-hmm. These are all phones that now support Qi charging. And I think now that people know that the iPhones support it, they're going to want to look into it. Do you think this is going to spur a wireless charging revolution?
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
This is now wireless charging is something that everybody will want to include because everybody buying phones thinks that it should have it.
It just became an essential in the way that water resistance became essential when the iPhone did it, especially for everything at the high end. It's going to be, I mean, look at the market right now, and it seems weird if you're charging $700+ for a phone that doesn't have water resistance. It's expected at that price point. And I think that's something we are definitely going to see with wireless charging over the next couple of years. It maybe will take a couple of years until we get there, but like we've all been theorizing, we've all been saying, I think you had an editorial, Daniel, on it earlier in the year, when the iPhone does it, suddenly is going to turn up everywhere. It's going to turn up in airports, you know, where we currently have USB ports. Suddenly, wireless charging outlets will start appearing. It won't just be a handful of Starbucks. It'll be every Starbucks. Anywhere where you're likely to stop to eat, to drink, to do anything for, say, 30 minutes or longer, there will be wireless charging there, especially in more tech-focused parts of the world.
More importantly, it's not just Google or Samsung contributing things to make the standard better. Now you have Apple doing it. And let's be honest, when Apple says or does something, everybody listens.
And my nightmare scenario for this was that Apple would do it, but they would do it in their own way and it would be incompatible with everything else. And it just wouldn't bring us forward anyway.
They did do it in their own way a little bit, but I think it's still, well, air power.
We don't really know what that is, though.
That's just three coils. Is that just three coils inside one thing?
No, it's a power control system that the three devices communicate with the base and each other. And none of that is in the Qi standard, but that doesn't mean that they don't fully support the Qi standard. That just means they've added more to it.
The Qi standard has been kind of messy even without Apple's involvement. You know, even just down to the location of the coils inside these things. You know, some phones have it in the back, some phones have the coil further up. The placement doesn't always line up depending on which device you're using. It's a standard in that it works, but it doesn't always work ideally. And it, maybe it's understandable that Apple wants its own thing that works as well as it possibly can with its own devices.
Sure. And other companies are going to make things that work better for Apple devices. And then Samsung's going to make their charging receiver coils in the same spot, so it works great with their phones too. This is going to benefit everyone.
So I want to talk about a report from, it was broken by SlashGear about how Starbucks is going to be updating its charging pads to support the iPhone. But as you know, you may know, Starbucks was on the side of PMA, which is the wireless power consortium's competition, the WPC built the Qi standard. And what's interesting about this report is that these pads inside Starbucks are actually connected to Wi-Fi. They are cloud connected, and they're going to be updated remotely to support Qi, which means that the technology inside PMA chargers is compatible in some way with Qi. It's just a choice that the vendors have made. And as we know with the Galaxy series that supports both Qi and PMA, it doesn't seem like there's different hardware that's necessary. You just need a single chip inside the phone to support both standards.
All you need is a coil that can oscillate at the correct frequency and some sort of circuit to manage and modulate the power that's created from it. Qi or PMA, that's just software.
Right. Is that disappointing at all? I mean, we've been sort of...
We also don't know if there's anything special about the kind of outlets that Starbucks has been using. That may be that the fact that it can work with both may be a quirk of the hardware that they deployed, in their premises. Who knows? It isn't necessarily something that applies to every single PMA charger.
Well, you're not going to be able to pull an old PMA power mat or something out of your closet and make it work. That's impossible. You can't pull the EEPROM off of it. It's soldered in. The software's coded on that forever. I'm sure Starbucks, they spent big money to think ahead so they don't have to tear out countertops if they want to change these things, which makes a lot of sense.
But this seems like an artificial standards war in some ways.
The standards war has kind of come and gone, I think. At the point where there's enough similarity between the two now that we can just do this. Obviously, it was kind of obvious a long time ago that Qi had basically won. Even with devices supporting both, Qi was the preferred standard.
That's sad and great at the same time. Qi's not the better of the two. If you're an electrical engineer and look at it, PMA's the better standard. It's more robust. It's going to be scalable. There's going to come a point in time where Qi charging is just not going to deliver. And that doesn't mean for your phone. That means for an electric train or something where PMA will scale higher, but Qi is more open.
So, PMA, in as much as it's been deployed in various places now, Jerry, is there a reason why whenever I would use PMA in a Starbucks, the charging speed would be such that I could eat like a 3-course meal in that Starbucks and it would charge maybe 5% of my phone during that time? It always seemed like PMA chargers in public places would be way slower than even the non-fast wireless chargers, the Qi chargers that you would get to use in your home.
Probably just a safety thing. They don't know, you're putting a phone on it. The next guy may put a Bluetooth headset on it, and they don't want to overcharge or get things too hot. So they're just probably putting out 2.7 volts, the minimum to charge, which, that's a bummer, but I can see the point in doing that too. You don't want to have to reimburse somebody for a burnt up pair of, rechargeable Bluetooth wireless charging headset or something.
Okay, so a couple of things here before we move on. The first is that a lot of people thought, or there were rumors floating around, that Apple would support this new, perhaps proprietary resonance-based wireless charging system that you would be able to put your phone anywhere on a given space and it would charge because it didn't need to be actually connected to the wireless charger, or it didn't need to use inductive charging, which needs to have a much closer proximity to the coils. And that didn't happen. And I'd love for you to comment on that, Jerry. But the other thing is that phones, if we're going to be moving in this direction towards a wireless charging revolution, all phones that support it will have to have a glass back, unless we can figure out a way to incorporate it into phones with a metal back.
Haven't we already figured that out with Qualcomm?
Google just covered their own behind there. That was possible when they said it wasn't. It's just expensive.
Okay, so what goes into making a phone support wireless charging with a metal back?
Just a stronger coil that doesn't have to be as close to the other coil to start to oscillate, which means you have to beef up the circuitry around it. So, I mean, it's probably upwards of 100% more. And, you know, $3 or $4 more to build a phone means something in the end.
Okay. So it'll basically just lead to slightly more expensive phones, if it leads to anything at all.
Right.
All right.
I mean, the way I see it developing is in the short term, everything will have a glass back because that's just what you'll need, especially the high end. I mean, we're already heading in that direction. That's just what you'll need to support wireless charging, which, as we've already kind of come to the conclusion, is, you know, will basically be this table stakes thing that you have to have at the high end. When someone eventually figures out a way to do it economically in a metal smartphone, it'll be, hey, remember how good it was when you had a metal phone, didn't get gunked up with fingerprints and you get all scratched up? And it'll be the return of the metal phone, and you know, it'll be almost like this cyclical thing that we go back to. You know, the kind of hallmark of a premium phone would be it had a metal body.
They're going to make either glass backed phones or a metal backed phone with a glass or plastic insert until they figure out how to build it cheaper. That's just how this kind of stuff works. I can't blame them. I mean, it's a lot of money to them.
Right. It is. I mean, these margins are fairly low as it is. Although for the high end, we're talking about, you know, phones that are still making a ton of money. So,
right.
But every cent counts. That was the other thing I wanted to talk about was that resonance charging. This has not really happened, and we've heard about it for years. Jerry, what needs to happen for ambient wireless charging to actually become a mainstream thing?
It's more of an experimental thing right now. It's ambient charging, especially past the 3 foot mark, you're 3 foot, more than 3 feet away from a source. There's the potential to kill you. Number one, because you may have fillings in your teeth that are close enough to each other, or a pacemaker, and you can't have over-the-air electricity killing people. So that's the big stopping point. The second is the size of the parts you need are going to be difficult to squeeze into a phone, and they're not much bigger than what we use for inductive resonance charging, and they're both resonant charging. Inductive, one is two magnets vibrate close to each other. That's what inductive basically means. It's give it a couple years, and then you'll see a company, and my bet is LG, will stick it in a phone.
Right.
But don't expect it for your next phone, and you won't be disappointed.
Okay. So I think, you know, these are all important improvements that will come to phones in the next couple of years. But it's also worth pointing out that it's, you know, looking at what was announced at the event this week from Apple with the iPhone 8 and the iPhone 10, it does seem like there's a lot of catch up happening. I just want to talk a little bit about that, because the iPhone 10 was the one the one more thing. It was the big deal. And this is the phone that brought OLED to the table for Apple. You know, Apple calls its OLED screen that is made by Samsung the only OLED display good enough to be in an iPhone.
And they're right.
But what is, you know, these are things that Apple has said for years and years and years. Jerry, what was your initial impression of the iPhone X? I mean, is this a good move for Apple? You know, they're potentially alienating some of the built-in audience with a $1,000 phone, a phone that does not have the familiar home button, that does away with Touch ID. You know, is this really the future of the smartphone? Obviously, we've seen it from Android for years, but what is your take?
I think it was risky, and the way they did it, they can call it a one-off experiment, and the iPhone 9 can look just like the iPhone you're used to. But as far as what they showed us themselves, I'm probably the wrong person to judge, because that TrueSight camera stuff going on up front with the Face ID has got me absolutely geeked out. I am more excited than I have been for any phone ever, because that's what I used to do and I know how it works and I have all these things I want to try and play with it. And it's got me hyped for the phone. The rest, you know, we shouldn't nitpick on the display. I have on good authority that that's an Apple designed and spec display that they had Samsung build, and it has individual subpixel color control that works with their True Tone, and that will if that's true, that will blow anything Samsung has made out of the water. Until Samsung does the same.
Samsung had subpixel rendering on the S8, I believe.
No, this is color correction, not rendering, where they can dial in how bright each individual subpixel glows to help tune the color. That's a big deal.
But as far as I understand, this requires a separate subcontroller on the phone itself.
Yeah. Yes.
Is this something that Android could incorporate?
Oh, certainly. I don't believe the technology is too difficult. It's just one of those things that, you know, most people wouldn't even think about doing, because is there a market for it? Well, now there is. And Samsung, their next phone could ship with it without any problems. None whatsoever.
Okay. Let's talk about that. What's the camera array called?
TrueSight. Let me double check. I think it's TrueSight.
But it's complicated.
Very.
And this allows Apple to do some facial recognition, biometric authentication that Samsung has been doing to a lesser degree with the S8, or it started with the Note 7 and iris scanning. They brought an improved face unlock technique to the S8 and now to the Note 8. Is this comparable? You wrote a nice big long piece about it this week, but you know, for the people who haven't read it, are they comparable?
The takeaway for most people that don't care about all the nerd technology is now you can use your face to unlock your phone and it's secure. Nobody can fool it.
So that's true the problem of the Samsung implementation.
No, the Samsung implementation is built on the Android implementation, and a good, you know, color laser printed photo of your face will fool it every time.
And to be fair, you know, it'll tell you that as you set it up.
Right. No, Samsung and Google don't even claim that to be secure. They claim it to be convenient. I would love to see them make it so it ties in with the thing where your watch or your location can keep your phone unlocked. So face unlock works only at home. That would be great.
What about iris scanning, though? Because that's not – you can't fool that.
Well, technically you can, but nobody is going to be able to. You need an almost perfect high-resolution photograph of your eye at the right angle to fool it. So I'm in the camp that means it's unbeatable, because nobody has that.
But it's also way less convenient than what Apple's built out.
The thing about iris scanning, and I listen to all you guys complain about it, and your complaints are justified, it has to be in the right spot, because it needs to collect the right information to be secure. If Samsung would cut down on what they needed to gather to verify your identity based on your iris pattern, it wouldn't be nearly as secure, but you could have more leeway in where the phone was positioned. This, if you've ever been in a, you know, in like a building that has iris scanning for some doors, you lay your head, there's a chin rest you put in and your head is held in a particular spot and it adjusts itself so it sees your irises at the correct angle and position. That's just how that technology has to work. So I don't knock Samsung for what they did. I think they've done an excellent job with the iris scanner.
And I think you're overestimating the kinds of buildings that Daniel and I go into there, Jerry.
Well, no, I mean, or me. I don't regularly go to a place like that. I just have been in one. But that's one thing that I think Samsung did a great job at, and I hope if they follow the Apple route and bundle some more high-tech face scanning in there, that'd be great, but don't lose the iris scanning because that's, if you get it in the right spot, it works every time and it's inherently very secure.
I think it's going to be interesting next year to see how that plays out because the rumors that we have right now suggest that Samsung will have the same old standard fingerprint sensor on the back on the S9, but then the Note 9 will finally be able to get it under the glass. So if you're Samsung, do you want to build out your own version of Face ID for a phone that you ship next spring? Or do you want to just suck it up and wait until you can get the fingerprint scanner under the glass for the Note the year after?
I don't think you wait. And the reason is not security or unlocking your phone. It's the smiling poop emoji.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe you're right.
Yeah, that kind of stuff where you can use the 3D mask of your face that was collected and do things like have animated emojis that talk while you're talking. That's cool stuff that people will really want. And Samsung wants to give people the things they like and keep them as customers.
Jerry, do you think this is something that we're going to see in, I mean, obviously Android doesn't benefit unless it exists at a platform level. Surely this is something Google is now thinking about for AR Core for the next generation of that.
Pretty much most of this was already in Tango phones, so that's not much of a leap to, you know, say, hey, Samsung, if you include this IC and this emitter at the top of your phone beside the camera, you can also bundle this into Android. That's not a big leap at all.
One of the lingering issues with the design of the iPhone X, I'm going to say X for the rest of my life.
Drink. Oh, there's a lot of them.
There's been a the human interface guide has been made public for developers to adapt their apps for iPhone X. And it seems like a bit of a usability nightmare because of this notch and the fact that you have to leave some space in both portrait and landscape mode for the new gesture area because there's no home button. Alex, we saw this to some extent on Android, when Google made it easier for developers to make scalable apps that adapted to the, you know, proliferation of different screen sizes and aspect ratios. And it seems now that most developers understand that building an Android app that adjusts dynamically is the right way to do it. But there are very few Android phones, except for, say, the Essential phone, that actually puts something physical in the way of the screen. This does seem like something that's going to divide the audience, and Android users rightfully made fun of this design decision. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the notch, I got to admit, just straight away. I'm also not a fan of Apple's implementation of the notch. When I first saw this in the leaks, my gut feeling was that what they would do, okay, you have an OLED screen, is that you permanently black out that area at the top, and then you just have, say, time signal notifications up there, and effectively to developers, that portion of the screen doesn't exist. And you make up for it by just having more space for your apps. Instead, what we have is this situation where app developers basically have to learn to live with a notch and to work around it. Straight up, Apple is the only hardware manufacturer that could get away with this kind of thing. it strikes me as needlessly complicating the way users need to think about interacting with their phones, and also the way developers need to think about building their apps for phones. I don't know. I can think of multiple ways that, to my mind, would have been better than what Apple currently has. You can see why they need a lot of space up there, given everything that is crammed into that area at the top of the screen. And you can also see why they wouldn't necessarily want to just do what LG and Samsung and Xiaomi and many other manufacturers have done. In a way, it's kind of an iconic look that you have the cutout at the top. And Apple is all about products with iconic looks. Maybe that's something built out over time. And you'll recognize it from a distance and say, okay, if someone has that notch cut out in their phone, then that means they're better than you because they have an iPhone 10. Maybe that'll be a thing that we see going forward, in the same way that there have already been think pieces this week talking about using an emoji as like a class indicator when you're chatting on iMessage or whatever.
My God, but, God help in terms us all.
But just in terms of the way it looks on the screen, I can think of so many ways that would have been better. Just blank that area out. Okay, you have OLED, you can do that now. I'm not a fan of it. If they're dead set on having this Face ID as the main way to do things going forward, maybe that's just the way it's going to be. But there's also this side of it that maybe we're just a year or two away from having the technology to do fingerprint reliably under glass. When that happens, you already have all this AR stuff. You know, you have the talking poop emoji that you've built out that you've gotten people used to. Apple is in a situation where they've already committed to having this notch at the top to support all that stuff, but at the same time, just a verification, a fingerprint is going to be just easier for the vast majority of people to use. So maybe a couple of generations of iPhone 10, you know, whatever the sequel is called, you have the notch, but then the original reason for including the notch, which is the lack of fingerprint, is no longer a thing. And it's just one of the many things about the future of the iPhone 10 range that is a little bit up in the air right now.
I think we're putting too much emphasis on the Face ID part of the camera system up there. That's a direct result of losing the home button, yes. But they'll figure it out. You can already put a fingerprint sensor under glass. It's just not really secure. So that's what they're going to work on fixing, and it'll get fixed.
But this is something that Qualcomm even said earlier this year, that it's now giving manufacturers a turnkey solution for under the glass by authentication. It won't be available until mid next year, but at least we have working prototypes of this solution.
Sure.
What's really interesting to me, though, is that it's unlikely Apple will go back to a fingerprint sensor in the future. It seems like it's made this decision. It very rarely goes back on those decisions, and it's basically committed to Face ID. I mean, I don't see Touch ID coming back in the iPhone, you know, 10.2. It just wouldn't make sense to me.
I agree. We have an unpopular opinion if you look on the internet, but I agree with you. It's Apple's done with that. This is their new thing. But regardless, that the array of infrared cameras and projectors, I would be willing to bet the next iPhone 11 has them on the back camera as well, because they can do so much cool things with the camera. It works well into their AR kit. It's just the right thing to do.
Okay, so let's use this to talk about what Samsung and other companies are going to do. You reckon that the Galaxy S9 will maintain its current, you know, dual facial biometric system and have an under-the-glass fingerprint sensor? Because right now it's not tenable. I mean, you cannot maintain the design of the current S and Note 8 series for another generation. The fingerprint is so poorly placed that people will just revolt. So what do they do?
I think you're right. I do believe that the next Galaxy that we hear about next February will have an in-glass fingerprint scanner. But I don't think they're going to lose the iris scanner or the face unlocking because it's not difficult to put it in there. They have it, or the hardware and the software already worked out, and there are people who like it and are used to it.
It's just so, like, every time I can go on streaks of like 10 times unlocking my Note 8 with iris scanning, and it's perfect and it's fast. And then there's that one time that it doesn't work. And then I try it again and it doesn't work. And nothing about my environment has changed. It's not like it's darker. It just doesn't work. And it's that situation that reinforces.
To be fair, the fingerprint scanner is like that a lot. And I wonder how much of that is Samsung and how, not necessarily the inherent quirk of the technology.
Right, but this is the most popular Android manufacturer. I mean,
sure. And we should hold them to high standards. I mean, this isn't necessarily a good answer for most people, but when I was using an S8 Plus full time, my solution to that was just to use a smartwatch and to use Smart Lock, because it was just pressing the virtual home key to unlock it, and having it unlock basically every time that my watch is in range or that I'm at a trusted location is just more convenient, to the point where if I'm on a plane and the watch isn't connected for whatever reason, or if I'm in any other location that isn't the case, it's actually, as you know, it's like a massive inconvenience. I mean, go back to actually lining your face up or lining your finger up with this finicky fingerprint scanner to try and unlock. Yeah, that's the situation that we're going to be in at the very least for the next year or so.
I think when they get a better solution for fingerprint unlocking, they'll loosen up on the security part of iris scanning and make it a little more easier to use. Right now, it's Daniel. You say sometimes it just refuses to work in the same environment. Maybe your eyes are a little bloodshot or your pupils are a little dilated. That changes the pattern of your iris.
Yeah, listen, I should be able to smoke a huge blunt and not have Samsung freak out.
But I have tried. You can't. If you get totally lit and your eyes get bloodshot, it just doesn't work.
See, that's...
I hear people say it doesn't work outside in the sun. It's not the sun. The sun has no bearing on the infrared light it emits. It's your eyes have contracted out in the sun and the iris pattern changed enough.
I'm not an ophthalmologist, but doesn't the retina itself stay static? Isn't it the iris that contracts and expands, right?
Right, and that's what they're scanning. I've heard the word retina scanner getting thrown around. I don't think they're scanning the retina.
Yeah, I just caught myself fake news thing in my brain.
Yeah,
where I'm like, I've been saying retina scanner, but it is the iris scanner.
Right, and the pattern of your iris stays the same. It doesn't change even as you age, but when your pupil contracts, there's more pattern than there was before. When your pupil expands, there's less pattern. To software, that's a change.
That is, and that's really difficult to accomplish, but that shouldn't be an impediment. I mean, Apple's solution is basically you're making dots of you're mapping your entire face using both infrared and very high resolution cameras, and you're making a 3D spatial map of your face,
right.
Which sounds like the right solution if it can be done fast enough.
My question is, and this is a Jerry question: how well is firing a bunch of infrared dots at your face going to work out where, you know, if you're in direct sunlight, if your face is already, being bathed in sunlight, how is the phone going to pick up these infrared dots? Or is it just going to default back to the less secure, optical face recognition?
That's going to depend on where at you are in the world and how much infrared light is coming from the sun. The bright part of sunshine that makes us squint, the camera doesn't even see that. That doesn't exist. It's black. It's set so it only sees two individual wavelengths of infrared light, one from the flood that illuminates your face and the other from the dot projection, which I don't know the wavelengths of either, but they will have good contrast between them, but still be under a threshold that burns you. So think of one as yellow and one as purple, even though there are colors that we can't see and have no idea what they look like. that has no, the bright sunshine means nothing to that. That's all filtered out and gone. But the sun does emit IR light. And if you're, I think, and somebody will correct me, but I think the further north you go, the more IR light the sun emits. So you could have a problem where maybe Phil down in Florida might not.
Hmm.
But then Phil's wearing sunglasses anyway, so he can't scan his reference.
It goes straight through. No, sunglasses mean nothing. Sunglasses cut UV light, not IR light. Get the darkest pair of sunglasses you can find, and your iris scanner will unlock your S8 without a problem.
I'm just used to Samsung's various things failing when I have sunglasses on. But
Alex, I wanted to ask you, because LG added face recognition to the V30.
They did.
And have you tried it yet?
I have, yeah, as part of the review. And there's, this video of me looking rather stupid setting it up in our video initial review. I didn't try it with sunglasses. UK, end of September, not really much reason to wear sunglasses. But it works really well in sort of middling light. The really interesting thing is it actually starts scanning before the phone's screen is on.
Yes.
And so as you lift it up, it activates it even while the screen is blank, so that when you, you know, press the power. I mean, there's also the fact that, you know, the fingerprint scanner is just so easy to reach, so why would you use it anyway? But let's assume you don't want to do that. Double tap the screen, it immediately recognizes it, and you can either set it to immediately unlock, which is a bit inconvenient because if you just want to look at your notifications, it'll take you straight to your home screen, or you can set it so that it'll recognize you and then you swipe to unlock. So my experience is that it works really well. I haven't noticed it being particularly finicky in the way that Samsung's is in low light. But at the same time, there's just less use case for it actually being there because LG's fingerprint is just in such a convenient location to begin with.
Correct.
Alex, turn your camera on and point the phone at the camera and make it act like it's trying to unlock with your face. And then we can count and see how many.
It straight up tells you that it'll work with a photo or it'll be less secure.
I'm just curious if it's using an IR emitter. You say it's better in low light. That could be an easy solution for that.
And I would need to check.
Yeah. An easy way to check is film it because
sure,
that'll show up on a camera. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Not sure. I do have footage. This is from GH5 that I was filming on, but I'm not sure how well filtered against infrared. That sensor is. So I'd have to check. But I do know, you're absolutely right. So a lot of cameras, especially consumer cameras, will see infrared.
When you said it works better in low light than what Samsung's doing, you know, that got me really curious why or how, and I think that's an easy solution. And if so, we should see that in the Galaxy S9.
Should.
Yep. I mean, they're obviously not talking about it doing anything as fancy as Face ID, but it would make sense if there was some kind of IR component to test that out.
I thought we were going to circle back around to that. I don't want to get everybody's hopes up because the key part of Face ID on the iPhone X is the new Apple chip and the coprocessor that does the processing for the facial recognition data. Qualcomm makes nothing in that leak. Samsung makes nothing in that leak. There was no reason for Qualcomm or Samsung to make something like that. It is insane that Apple makes it because it's not cost efficient and it's silly from an engineering point of view. I don't want anybody to think I'm knocking what we can get in our Android phones, but the Snapdragon 835 is not going to cut it.
Well, it's really interesting because, you know, this is not directly related, but we've seen a ramp up of anti-Apple marketing from Qualcomm. You know, the day before the iPhones were unveiled, Qualcomm released an infographic to us and every other media, you know, site.
Yeah.
It was pretty shoddily put together about firsts from Qualcomm, you know, things that Qualcomm had done far earlier than Apple, including wireless charging and biometric authentication and things like that. And it's going to be very interesting to see because the iPhones are still using Qualcomm chips, at least for the CDMA versions. And
they have to.
They have to because Qualcomm owns the CDMA patents in the U.S. But Qualcomm and Apple are going to be going to court, and there are suits and cross suits, and these companies are basically more at their at each other's throats than Samsung and Apple ever were. And you know, this is going to essentially be the conversation over the next few years. Qualcomm is behind Apple when it comes to performance from the systems on a chip, but Qualcomm does all these other things too that Apple doesn't.
Well, the difference there, and I've had this discussion with Renee, Qualcomm makes a chip that performs well and is cost effective for other vendors to buy and put in small mobile devices. What the Snapdragon 835 is, you do not need any more processing power than it delivers. And you get the benefits because you bought from Qualcomm of better Wi-Fi, better wireless all around, Bluetooth 5, the ability to use more than one headset at a time if the vendor wants to pay for that license. You get a lot more coming, you know, if you bought a Qualcomm chip. But Apple, I'm going to assume the A11 is better because they told me it was better, but the A10 is more, you know, they could put the word Pentium on it and nobody would bat an eye. It is, they're building it so they can run MacBooks with it. That's what they're doing. I don't care what anybody tells me. That's the only reason you build a chip that can do that. They want one chip across all their devices.
Interesting.
So it's a ton of overkill, but they can use that overkill to do things like Face ID.
So this is something that Android users always want to tackle. You know, the performance aspect. Everybody wants their phones to be as powerful as possible. Snapdragon 835 is pretty damn powerful, and as we learned from recent leaks, there won't be a Snapdragon 836 to power the upcoming Pixel 2 and Pixel 2 XL or Pixel XL 2, as previously thought. Alex, last year's Snapdragon 821 debuted on the Pixels and they came to subsequent devices. Do you think it's significant that this year that won't be the case for Google's flagships?
No, and Jerry may disagree with me based on, you know, certain changes between the 820 and 821 in terms of the GPU, but to my mind, and I'm only going off you know, third party leaks here. I think it was Evan Blass that reported this week that the silicon refresh that they wanted to do with the 836 just wasn't going to be ready in time. So instead, it's perhaps been bumped to early next year, and maybe we'll have a different number associated with it. So maybe we'll get a similar, you know, or comparable silicon refresh in early 2018, but it'll be called maybe, I don't know, an 838 or an 840 or something.
Yeah.
Yep.
most of that stuff is artificial. It's the difference between the 820 and the 821 was what Qualcomm will support. The 820 supports everything the 821 does, but Qualcomm doesn't include that support on the 820. So that's a big part of it. I mean, Qualcomm is they're in business to make money. So
sure.
I take issues with a lot of the way they support their products, but they are what they are. I can't change it.
Yeah, I mean, Qualcomm's policy in terms of you know, graphics support and stuff is a big reason why a lot of phones weren't supported up to Nougat on the 32-bit side. So that's definitely a thing. I wouldn't worry too much about, you know, the fact that phones shipping this year are only going to have an 835. That's like we were talking about before. That's way more power than you would ever need anyway.
Daniel, these 600 class Snapdragons, they're pretty damn good in a phone, aren't they?
Well, I've yet to use one. I don't have a phone that runs the 630. But I'm looking forward to it because the Moto X4 is running the 630, which is the successor to the 625 and 626, which...
Yeah, I meant the 626. I meant new as in the past couple generations of the 600 series.
Right, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I'm looking forward to using the new one, too, with all the extra wireless support. But they have enough muscle to do 99% of the things that 99% of the users would ever want to do on their phone.
Right.
and they do it well.
Right.
Yeah, and if you look at the differences between a 600 series chip and an 800 series chip, there are two things that stand out. One is LTE. So the 800 series right now is the only way to get gigabit LTE. If that's something that you care about, which maybe you do, maybe you don't. I mean, it's deployed in so few places. The other thing is the ISP.
Right.
Especially as computational photography becomes more important, the way that you get extra performance out of a run-of-the-mill sensor with OIS with a bright lens is you have a really great SoC in there that can take all that information and through computational magic make a really great looking photo out of it. And if those are two things that you're not necessarily too bothered about, then you're right. For everything that you want to do with a phone, a modern 600 series chip properly optimized is going to do everything.
Yep. And you can get good photos with it too if they built the camera correct. But what Alex meant was the Pixel just has the same sensor as everything else and takes such great pictures because of the 821 chip.
And there are certain phones like the OnePlus 5 and G6 and V30 that lean heavily on that ISP as well. And that's the legitimate way to do things.
Right.
You don't necessarily want to, you don't necessarily want to blow a bunch of money on, the chip that Samsung uses in the S8. Instead, you go with a higher resolution, a brighter lens, and that faster ISP, and you get pictures that are just as good, if not better, many occasions.
And you're paying for it. You can't buy an 835 without it, so you might as well use it.
So today, Andrew Rubin of Essential, he hosted a Reddit Ask Me Anything, and obviously the camera was one of the more pressing matters. The widespread criticism of the Essential phone's camera. Andrew Rubin responded to a question, what are your plans to address the widespread criticism of the Essential phone's camera? What are the challenges and the plans for future software improvements on it? And Rubin replied, we are pretty happy with the hardware design of the camera. We're using computational photography to fuse a monochrome and color sensor. That's the part we're not too happy about. But luckily, it's software, and we've already done a number of updates to the app to fix bugs and add features. Alex, what do you think of that response?
Accurate, probably. I mean, yeah. on the one hand, if you want to take the cynical view, he wouldn't say they're not happy with the hardware because there's no way of changing that.
Too late now.
Yeah. On the other hand, he's right in that you can achieve a lot through software updates on phones because it is just, although it relies on the ISP is already there. And you can just tune the software to take better advantage of that. My biggest criticism of that is that's something that you do before you charge $700 for your phone.
Right.
I mean, not on him personally, but he's the one answering the question.
No. I was lucky enough to meet Andy Rubin. I don't know, maybe his personal life is different, but he is one awfully nice and humble guy. And I feel bad for him if he had a Reddit Ask Me Anything about the Essential phone, because I can only imagine what it was like. And I don't know, I guess I just think he's an awful nice guy, and I'm sure people gave him a hard time. He's not doing this on purpose. It's just something going on that needs fixed, and he'll fix it.
I'm sure his billions of dollars will serve as some comfort.
Yeah.
Before we move on to the last topic, I do want to mention, though, that I spent the day taking photos with the Essential phone, and I have been very impressed with the quality. The app itself is a pile of garbage, and that can hopefully be improved. But once, if you're in the right position and the camera doesn't hang or the shutter doesn't decide to just like not go when you say it should go, you get some really great photos. Low light is still an issue, and it's not going to magically get fixed overnight, but it's not like, this isn't Moto X bad, right? Like back when the Moto X and Moto X 2 came out, those phones were basically unusable in anything that resembled low light. This is not that bad. It's disappointing because the Pixel and the Galaxy S8 and the G6 exists, but it's not the worst that...
I mean, more than that, I was, Andrew and I, so I, at IFA, was for the first couple of days using the OnePlus 5. Andrew had the Essential phone. We were taking pictures side by side in low light, and it was very telling that, and this is maybe one or two software versions ago, But in every one of those situations, despite the OnePlus 5 being at a disadvantage in terms of the raw optics, in every single situation in a low light, the OnePlus 5 would take a better picture than the Essential phone. And of course, Essential is a younger company than OnePlus, but it wasn't too long ago that OnePlus was making the kinds of mistakes that Essential is making. So it was very interesting to see, especially just given the price difference between those two phones, that... Yeah, OnePlus is, or at least was, running rings around that device in low light performance.
A while back, we all gave Vic Gandotra a bunch of gruff about saying that the iPhone camera was better, whatever. Portrait mode changed my life. The one thing he was right about is computational photography is the future. Any poor dark lens, as long as it's mounted properly and can open and close the electronic shutter fast enough, gets way more visual information than your eyes can see. You just need to find a way to process that. Of course, a better lens gets better image, you know, data, and makes it easier to process. But as the idea, the hardware, and the software involved in computational photography gets more mature, we're going to see even budget crappy phones take really good pictures, and that's a good thing.
I mean, the whole Vic Gandotra thing with implying that this is nothing I haven't said elsewhere, but I mean, the area where he's wrong is suggesting that Apple has this monopoly on computational photography, where it's at the heart of at everything that Google's doing right now and everything that Qualcomm's doing right now, for the reasons that Jerry just explained.
Right.
Well, I hope that next year, or maybe this year, and we just haven't seen it, Apple's their front-facing camera with the extra data it collects, it could outclass every phone out there if that's what they wanted to do with it. I don't think that's what they wanted to do this year, but maybe next year they'll work on taking that data that unlocks your phone and makes talking poop emojis and doing more than just killing the background in a studio-style portrait. They could do a lot with that.
And there's plenty of space around the back for putting that stuff there without having a notch.
Okay, so let's use that then to bring us to the last topic of the day, which is the Pixel 2. Today, it was announced that the Pixel 2 will be launched on October 4th at an event in San Francisco. There's going to be satellite events. We know of at least one in Toronto. Alex, have they announced one in London yet?
I haven't heard anything just yet, but they did last year, so I'll have to wait and see.
Right. So we do know that it's coming. We know that the smaller version will be made by HTC. It's going to look a lot like the original Pixel. The larger Pixel XL 2 will be built by LG, and it'll look a lot more like the G6 than, say, the Pixel XL. So
I would say front of a V30, back of a Pixel, basically.
Business at the front, party in the back, or something.
Something like that.
So this is a phone that really emphasizes, or the Pixels at least, were phones that emphasized computational photography. Alex, what else can we expect from the Pixels this year, and how will they essentially build on the success of the first and hopefully fix some of the mistakes of the first as well?
Well, the first thing is just being able to buy them. I mean, you can argue all day about whose fault it is, and we've talked to people behind the scenes, and no one seems to agree on whose fault it is that you couldn't actually reliably buy a Pixel for the first 4 months. Hopefully, they've fixed that logistical issue there. So that's one thing. But, I mean, I don't. It's not necessarily a given that Google is just going to have this clear path to build on what they established last year. For starters, the market is much more challenging than it was in 2016. You have exciting new iPhones. Last year, the iPhone was kind of boring.
Yep.
The Note is a thing this year. Even LG has a much stronger lineup than they did in 2016. And this is all happening around products from Google, which, you know, the small one, it looks like, is going to have these giant bezels. It's going to look like a phone from the past. Well, I mean, that's a good thing if you're Jerry. If you don't like phones with tiny bezels. But the other thing is, maybe this is the part that we're not fully aware of just yet, but it's going to be software and services, because the Pixel UI, okay, maybe they'll have a new launcher, but is there really going to be much in terms of the core OS and the core UI that we haven't seen on the current Pixels? Probably not. It's going to come down to things like the Google Eye? Is that the name of it?
Lens?
Google Lens,
Google
yeah.
Google Lens, yeah.
So the stuff they showed at I.O. In terms of using computational photography to get information, kind of a cross between your standard camera app and Google Assistant. Obviously, that's a prime thing that would potentially ship first in new Pixels. Of course, we saw Google Assistant first in the first-gen Pixels. What other features now are Google going to choose the second-gen Pixels to showcase? And I think that, more than just the way it looks or the build or anything like that, potentially will be the biggest potential selling point for these two new phones.
Google is unable to release anything so cool that Samsung isn't ready to release right away. Period. If they piss Samsung off, Android is done.
Okay, but we know a bunch of things about the Pixel 2. We know that it's going to forego a headphone jack in favor of dual speakers on the front. That was a big criticism of the first Pixel, is that it just didn't utilize those massive bezels above and below the screen. So that's a trade-off. Whether it's a good one, that remains to be seen. But I appreciate good dual speakers. I mean, Alex, you've used Sony phones for years that have fantastic speakers, the HTC, 1M7, 1M8. They all had amazing front-facing speakers.
I mean, I just want to see the justification for getting rid of the headphone jack, because Google's product team doesn't necessarily share future products with the advertisers for the first-gen Pixels, but everyone remembers that ad for the first Pixel where it dunked on Apple for getting rid of the headphone jack, and now Google's doing the exact same thing. If it's anything like HTC's justification, it's going to be pretty threadbare. So I don't know what the justification is there. And the other thing, okay, we have the Edge Sense type thing, which, okay, maybe it'll activate Assistant or whatever. I don't know. I'm seeing a lot of gimmickry and not a whole lot else right now on the hardware.
If I had to make a bet, the big thing is going to be something they're doing with AR Core. They've had this in the wings, and this was going to be their big reveal. And since, Apple did what they did, they had to start talking about AR Core more now. But it's going to be a miniature Project Tango built into a Pixel.
With a single camera?
I don't know what they can do there on the back. I'm talking more about what we can't see from all the leaked images that might be under the glass in the front.
Yeah, but that also, that just doesn't sell phones yet. Like, I just don't think AR is going to be able to sell people on the Pixel.
But we think of AR as like putting a dinosaur or a UFO in a picture of your backyard barbecue. But there's a lot of other things they could do with knowing about your environment and knowing where the edges of everything is, and incorporate fun stuff into selfies.
Right.
I mean, just look at, classic case, look at what Apple's doing with, Animoji. Every chance Google could do something comparable.
The Snapchat masks.
Well,
you
would need to do something at the API level, and it's been suggested that it'll be 8.0.1, which means no new API level, which you would need for that kind of stuff. Maybe AR Core, maybe not. Who knows?
I'm pretty sure that all time Project Tango devices were Marshmallow and Nougat, right?
Right.
So it's built into Android to support that stuff at some level. I wouldn't rule out some fancy hardware. I'm not saying it's there. That's just, I can't think of anything else they can do to justify their billboard that says you should, whatever it says about waiting.
Expect more from
to
your
buy
phone
your next
or whatever.
Phone. So right.
Here's the teaser, and there's a bunch of questions. They're very pointed. Obviously, they will impact the marketing. First is, what's wrong with my phone's battery? Clearly, this is a point of emphasis. Google wants to improve the battery life. That mm-hmm. will be the case just by virtue of the Snapdragon 835. It'll be more efficient.
Just by virtue of Oreo, right?
And that Oreo itself is a lot better.
Exactly. So the other one is, why is my phone always out of storage? We may see Google take not just cloud photo storage to the next level, but maybe device storage in general will be pushed more to the cloud. I mean, we saw Nextbit do it. Could be a thing.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Did Razer buy that technology from Nextbit, or
I mean, even
was
if
that
they
available
didn't,
for someone else?
Even if they didn't, it would be trivial for Google with the infrastructure that they have to build something like that.
Right, right. I could just, you know, maybe if they didn't directly pick them up and buy it, they just talk to the right people who are, because, you know, laugh at the Robin if you want, but that storage worked really well. You just had to have online all the time.
Yeah, all that was Nextbit's own software tying into AWS. Because I asked them how they were doing it, and that's exactly what it was. And Google, with everything they have built out for Drive, could very easily do that.
Right. A few changes to the permission model in Android where you could remotely install things without being through the Play Store, and it was done, and it worked. It was great.
I just hope this isn't justification for sticking at 32 gigs for the base model.
Good point. Next one, why does my phone take so many blurry photos? Obviously, that's a point of emphasis. The Google is an amazing phone for photography. We'll definitely see an improved camera. It'll be single, but it'll be an improved experience. You know, what else can Google do? That's with the camera. I mean, there's not a whole lot other than we
put two of them, three of them. I mean, well, you can always add more.
No. For the nerds, they can explain why one lens is better than two. If you can do the things in software that you need two lenses on other phones to do, that's pretty cool. Two lenses is I'm disappointed in Samsung especially because they have a huge budget and a huge development team. And they could be working on computational ways to pull out grayscale and adjust for depth instead of using a second camera. That's the future, not adding more lenses.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's a selling point. Is we can do it with one camera, and these other competitors who we really don't want to make angry because we are glad they're our partners have to use two. They're not going to say that.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't buy it. I don't think they're worried about pissing off Samsung.
I know they are.
I mean, if they weren't, it depends to what extent. It's not like it's not a binary thing, and they can get away with doing a lot without crossing Samsung too much.
They can't introduce an Android feature that OEMs aren't ready for. That's the extent of my understanding. They can develop them ahead of time, and they're already working on what's going to be in the Pixel 3.
And it's not like any of this stuff is news to Samsung. Right. Samsung probably already knows what's on the roadmap for Android P.
Absolutely. And anything that shows up in the next Pixel can also be in the Galaxy S9. It doesn't mean it will be, but Samsung can put it there. They're ready for it. And that's where their hands are tied a little bit. They can't go and throw this, you know, I use Face ID as an example because that's what we're all talking about. They can't say, well, Android supports that with the new 8.0.1 and it's built into the Pixel. Unless their big partners are, you know, ready at the hardware and software level to do that on their next devices.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the Pixel did was it introduced a bunch of features with 7.1 that eventually were, you know, became accessible to OEMs. It's interesting that phones like the GS8 launched with 7.0, not 7.1. But again, that's not really a big deal. There's a lot of stuff with the Pixel 2 that remains to be seen. One thing that our friend at Android Police, David Ruddick, tweeted about this morning, that the Pixels may be Verizon exclusives again in the U.S., obviously, they'll be sold unlocked, but it would be unfortunate if Verizon did decide to get it as an exclusive again, at least for people on other carriers looking for it.
Not unfortunate for Verizon or Google, and that's
no, just for the average person who doesn't love exclusives. The Essential phone is an exclusive to Sprint, Galaxy S8 Active an exclusive to AT&T. I mean, they still exist. So
maybe speaks to where Google sees the Pixel in terms of, you know, other devices. Obviously, it is still a bit more niche if it's limited to one carrier, and you know, obviously that's not something that applies to Samsung or Apple. So
eventually Google has to want to sell more than 5 million phones.
It'll happen eventually, but obviously, right, this year isn't the if yeah, what he's hearing is right. This year isn't the year.
Right.
Yeah. And you know, they it's my understanding they were more than satisfied with the amount of, you know, Pixels and Pixel XLs they sold. That's not self-sustaining. Eventually, if they want to continue to, you know, produce their own phones, they have to make a phone that you can buy easily.
And I think there were, earlier this year, I think in around March, there were rumors, well, not rumors, but the people were judging Pixel sales based on apps, app installations in the Play Store. It doesn't work like that. And I think this was around about the point where I think it was the milestone was either 500,000 or 1,000,000. And Jerry, I forget whether I heard this from you or whether we heard it from independent places, but as of March, I think the number was about 5 times higher than that. So that was a decent number for the first 6 months, given that the availability was kind of scarce as well.
You know, the rounded off numbers that I have heard were 3.5 million on Verizon and 1.5 million through Google Play.
Yeah, I think I heard 5 from somewhere. I forget where it was as of the first 6 months.
That's rounded off. It could be, you know, 4.5 million, or it could be 5.5 million. But that's what they wanted to sell, apparently. I mean, they didn't make any more than that.
Yeah, I mean, it's more essential phones than Andy Rubin's going to sell.
Yeah. And the thing is that that's all they made. They had to make new ones because people still wanted them. So that is a clue that that's how many they wanted to sell. But eventually they, and I think it's going to be after they design their own chip. I think that's what they're waiting for. And I think everybody that's interested in that kind of stuff is absolutely certain that Google is working on building their own smartphone.
Stick it to Qualcomm as well as Verizon at the same time.
I think they'll probably partner with Qualcomm. That's the Google way. They like to partner with other companies and share the wealth as long as they get their piece. But it has to come to the point where Google says, okay, this is the best phone you can buy. Just buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And they put it out there for everyone to buy. I just don't know when that'll be.
Well, I think the first thing they have to do is just make them widely available. That was the problem with the first one. And hopefully that is going to be resolved this time. I think we should end things there and pick things up again next week when we know a little bit more likely of the Pixels. I'm guessing more will leak as we get closer to the event on October 4th.
By next week, everybody that works at every Android blog will have held one. That's just the way this works.
We'll see. It is interesting that I'm sure things were a lot leakier last year. I remember seeing a lot more a lot earlier last year, and especially in terms of renders and in terms of live pictures of the device. We've seen a few things this year, but I feel like it's been kept under wraps a little better than it was a year ago.
I think last year we saw a lot of stuff from the carrier partner, and that's been clamped down this year.
And the carriers are the leakiest of all, so maybe.
It is interesting that we haven't seen any live photos of the LG version of the Pixel 2. Just the HTC built one. So lots remaining there. So we'll end things this week. Alex, where can people find you if they want to learn more?
You can find me on the social things, on the Twitter and Instagram and whatnot, at Alex Dobie. You can find my stuff on androidcentral.com. Mostly you can find video stuff from me on youtube.com/androidcentral, including our reviews of the V30 and the Note 8, which is kind of my work, but also kind of Andrew Martinick's work.
Well, you did a fantastic job on those videos. Those two of your best videos, and I highly encourage you, or you, the listener, to go and watch them.
I'm going to go watch them again anyway.
Just do it. Toot your own horn, man. Jerry, where can people find you?
I don't know. I work at Mobile Nations. You'll find me at any of the sites, jerry@thesitename.com, or on Twitter, and it's at GBHIL. And I shy away from most everything else. I don't have the nerves for it.
Yeah, it just takes too much out of you. I hear you.
It does. It gets hard.
Well, my name is Daniel Bader. You can find me at Journey Dan on all the things. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
See you later.
Adios.